ceiling windows glowing from the lighted chandelier in the hallway. The wind was up, and the trees were filled with shadows that seemed to battle one another. Three of his live oaks were registered with the National Conservation Society and named Mosby, Forest, and Longstreet, perhaps indicating a tired and old and depressing southern obsession with the illusion that war is grand. But I had a hard time thinking of Levon in that fashion. He avoided crowds and formal social situations and conventional thinking, and he had a pathological aversion to people who asked questions about his work. He seldom spoke specifically of his family, but supposedly they were related to Oliver Hazard Perry, John Mosby, Edmund Burke, and John Wilkes Booth. He said he'd grown up in Galveston, or Lake Charles, or Lafayette, or maybe all three, I'm not sure. He was one of those paradoxical individuals who became notorious for his obsession with privacy. He had lived in the tropics, and had known leftists in Mexico, and DEA agents in Colombia, and CIA operatives who flew for an airline headquartered in Fort Lauderdale. Why he had been drawn into the edges of the new American empire, no one knew. With his tall frame and genteel manners and kind face and egalitarian attitudes, he seemed to personify virtue. Strangely, although they looked nothing alike, he and Jimmy Nightingale made me think of bookends that belonged on the same shelf. I sometimes saw Levon's wife at Red Laurel's Health and Racket Club in Lafayette, in boxing trunks and a halter, sweaty and dedicated, slamming the body bag hard enough to rattle it on the chain. She was Australian, and had dark hair and wide-set blue eyes that stared boldly into your face. She seldom spoke or smiled, and if she had any expression, it seemed to be one of puzzlement or wariness, as though the world were constantly deconstructing and reassembling itself before her eyes. Before I could get out of the limo and ring the bell, Levon and Rowena came out the front door. Levon put his wife inside the limo, then leaned across the seat and shook Jimmy's hand vigorously.
"It's very nice to meet you, sir. This is my wife, Rowena. Thank you for your kind invitation. How are you doing, Dave?"
That was Levon, the effusive gentleman no matter the occasion. But his cordiality had no influence on what was about to take place. Jimmy's eyes were glued on Rowena's. The connection was electric and naked to the degree that both of them were obviously embarrassed. She sat down heavily on the leather seat, her gaze never leaving Jimmy's.
"You're a screenwriter?" she asked him.
"Not really. I try at it."
"Does anyone have a drink?" she said.
"I started to ice some champagne, but I didn't think we'd be long in getting to the restaurant," Jimmy said.
"We're fine," Levon said.
"I'm starved and dry," she said. "Can we get the bloody hell out of here?"
"Righto," Jimmy said. He tapped the glass behind the driver.
"Is this your vehicle?" Levon said.
"My vehicle?
No, it belongs to the car service," Jimmy replied clearly, not sure what was happening. "I'm not that uptown."
"Hello, Miss Rowena, I'm Dave Robichaud," I said. "I've seen you at Red's Health Club in Lafayette."
"You're who?"
"We spoke on the phone." Her window was up. She stared at her reflection in the dark. Then she turned and looked at Jimmy again, as though seeing him for the first time. Levon leaned forward, interdicting her line of sight.
"You keep company with Bobby Earle, Mr. Nightingale?"
"Call me Jimmy. I know Earle, but I wouldn't call him a close friend."
"A friend, nonetheless," Levon said.
"Judge not lest you be judged," Jimmy said.
"What's to judge? His record is demonstrable, isn't it?" Levon said. "If he had his way, the bunch of us would be soap."
"I think he's paid for his sins," Jimmy said.
"His time in prison?" Levon said.
"Considering the ethnic makeup of the population, I suspect he found himself in the middle of a nightmare," Jimmy said.
"I don't think that's much solace to the victims of the Ku Klux Klan."
"Oh, shove it along, you two," Rowena said. She massaged the back of her neck and rotated her head, glancing sideways at Jimmy.
"Good advice," Jimmy said, reaching for something on the floor.
Rowena rolled down her window, flooding the limo with the smell of night-blooming flowers and the sprinklers spinning on the St. Augustine grass in the dark. "Look at the stars. Did you ever see Night Has a Thousand Eyes? When the constellations are out, I always think of that movie. Look, each star is vaporous."
"What do you have there?" Levon asked.
"A sword," Jimmy said, lifting it into the light.
"I think it belonged to your great-grandfather. I'd like you to have it."
Levon looked at the name and sized on the handle. "My God, where did you get this?"
"Did anybody hear me?" Rowena said. "Has anyone seen Night Has a Thousand Eyes?"
"I have," Jimmy said. He pushed the sword away when Levon tried to return it. "It starred Edward G. Robinson and Gail Russell. Did you see her in Angel and the Bad Man or Wake of the Red Witch?"
"Yes," Rowena said, her face thrust forward, her wide-set eyes filled with interest.
"How about rolling up the window, Rowena?"
Levon said.
"The air smells like insecticide."
"If that's what everyone wants," she replied.
"Listen here," Levon said. "I can't accept this gift."
"Maybe we can give it to a museum," Jimmy said. "It needs to be somewhere other than in the hands of its previous owner."
Levon waited for Jimmy to continue.
"I got it from Fat Tony Nemo. He bought it at a flea market," Jimmy said.
"You know Nemo?" Levon said.
"He poured the concrete for a couple of my buildings."
"I forgot. He does that when he's not killing people," Levon said.
"Tony was out of the rackets 20 years ago," Jimmy said.
"Is that right, Dave?" Levon said.
"This guy who used to break arms and legs with a baseball bat found salvation."
"I wouldn't know," I replied, regretting the choices I had made to help Cleet.
"Could you tell your driver to go a little faster?" Rowena said to Jimmy. "I'm about to faint."
"No down under histrionics tonight," Levon said.
"Oh, balls," she said. "I need to write you a check for this," Levon said to Jimmy. "Show me the secret to your novels instead."
"Beg your pardon," Levon said.
"I'm envious. They're marvelous books. Your prose is magical. I want to know how you do it."
Then Rowena said something I didn't expect, considering the undisguised arousal Jimmy obviously caused in her.
"We all have our private cubbyholes, love. Don't be fucking with them."
The chauffeur was a peroxided, crew-cut, steroid-pumped weightlifter with a concave-shaped face whose eyes looked like lumps of lead in the rearview mirror. I wanted to get in the front with him.
Clementine's was on Main Street in a building that once was a saloon and pool hall and betting parlor with wood floors and a stamped tin ceiling and a long bar and cuspidors and a potbelly stove, in a time when saloon owners one night a week covered pool tables with oilcloths and served free robin gumbo. Now it was a fine restaurant, with a large, formally attired staff and sometimes a famous movie actor or musician among the guests. Unfortunately, none of this was any comfort to me. The atmosphere at our table was poisonous, the tension unbearable, primarily because there was no way to both acknowledge and resolve the problem, which was raw hatred between Jimmy and Levon, and, I suspect, a flicker or two of the green-eyed monster in Levon.
"You understood about my writing a check, didn't you?"
Levon said.
"If you want," Jimmy said.
"There's no if to it."
Jimmy smiled.
"I think I gave him $2,000 for it. Why don't you give that amount in my name to a charity?"
"Why don't I just leave it on the table for the waiter?" Levon said.
Rowena was on her third glass of burgundy.
"My grandfather was at Gallipoli. A neighbor tried to give him a souvenir bayonet to cut his 100th birthday cake. Grandfather told him where to park it."
"Lower the volume, Rowena," Levon said.
"Fuck if I will," she replied.
How about that for conversation in a small city on Bayou Teche where decorum is a religion and manners and morality are interchangeable? The back of my neck was burning, my scalp drawing tighter each time Rowena had something to say.
I went to the restroom, located in a separate building by the patio, and washed and dried my face and went back inside. The bar area was crowded, but in the midst of drinkers, I saw Cleet Purcell hunched over a po'boy sandwich and a frosted mug of beer. When I went to places where alcohol was served, I usually avoided sitting at the bar or at tables where people were there to drink rather than eat. Those distinctions might seem foolish to normal people, but the slip that puts a sober alcoholic back on the dirty boogie usually has innocuous origins. You accidentally eat chocolate cake that has whiskey in it? There's brandy in the plum sauce. 2 miles from shore, the sun blazing on your head, a friend tosses you a cold can of Miller from the ice chest. Or worse, you wake at 1 in the morning, your head full of nightmarish images, and rather than deal with your dragons, you put on your beat-up leather jacket and a wilted hat and find an end-of-the-line dive that has no clocks or windows. But I wanted to be near Cleet, the man who'd carried me down a fire escape when I had 2 bullets in my back, a man who sought excoriation and feared approval, a blue-collar iconoclast who had to look up the word. "Can you tell me how to get to Sharky Bonanno's dream room?" I said. Sharky's joint on Bourbon used to feature musicians like the Kings of Dixieland and Johnny Scat Davis and Louis Prima and Sam Butera, and Cleet and I had spent many wasted days and nights there. Cleet jumped when I put my hand on his shoulder. "Jesus, Dave, you know I have a coronary when people walk up on me like that. When did you come in?"
"I'm with Jimmy Nightingale and Levon and his wife."
"You're kidding." He strained his neck to see into the dining room. "Oops, I shouldn't have looked."
"What do you mean?"
"That Australian broad gets to me. My big boy just went on red alert."
"Will you stop that?"
"I know an animal when I see one."
"I mean it, Cleet." But what was the point? Cleet was Cleet. "Join us. I feel like I'm in the middle of a blender."
"I can't take Nightingale. I know he's cutting me a deal, but he's still a bum and a fraud."
"But it's fine for me," I said.
"Stop pretending. Nightingale hates my guts. I don't know what you see in that prick. Anyway, he's doing a favor for you, not me. He wants something from Levon Broussard. So does Tony Nineball."
"Where'd you hear this?"
"From Nig Rosewater."
Nig and Wee Willie Bimstein had run New Orleans' oldest bail bond service until Katrina drowned the city and FEMA transported their clients all over the United States, never to return.
"Tony thinks he's going to be a Hollywood movie producer," Cleet said. "He bought this sword to give to Levon Broussard, except Nightingale took it away from him."
"When did Fat Tony start rolling over for anyone?"
"He's got diabetes and emphysema and cancer in his colon and lymph nodes. He carries a bucket in his car to puke in."
The bartender leaned close to Cleet. "Would you like another drink, sir?" Cleet lifted his mug, the shell of ice sliding down the sides, the beer almost to the top.
"Do I look like I need one? But since you asked, give Dave a diet doc with cherries and limes in it."
The man on the other side of Cleet left the bar, and I took his stool with no plan in mind other than to delay rejoining the group I'd come with. In seconds, I felt at home, the television set tuned to a sports channel, stuffed shrimp I hadn't ordered placed on a paper napkin in front of me, someone talking about the New Orleans Saints. Cleet ordered a shot and poured it into his mug. I watched the whiskey bounce on the bottom and rise in a brown cloud. "Why not just put your brain in a jar and give it to a medical school?" I said.
"I did that 5 years ago. They gave it back."
He chugged half the mug. I bit into a stuffed shrimp and looked over my shoulder at the dining room, then at the icy cloud rising from the beer box. The bartenders uncorking bottles of Liebfraumilch and dark red wine, fitting an orange slice on the rim of a Collins glass, tipping a jigger of Jack into shaved ice and mint leaves, pouring a creamy pink gin fizz, setting up a round of Hennessy for everyone, provided by the distributor. "No," the bartender said after setting a shot glass in front of me. I cleared my throat to answer.
"Did he ask for one?"
Cleet said. "Sorry, my mistake," the bartender said.
"Give us both a diet doc. I need a bowl of gumbo, too," Cleet said.
"You got it," the bartender said.
"Where you from?" Cleet asked.
"California."
You ever hear of the Bobbsey twins from Homicide?
That's a new one on me, the bartender said. He wore a white jacket. His hair slicked back.
You're looking at them, Cleet said. You're standing in the middle of history.
Knock it off, Cleet, I said.
He knows I'm kidding, Cleet said. You, what's your name? You don't take people like me seriously, do you?
My name is Cedric.
You knew I was kidding, right, Cedric?
The bartender wiped the bar. Two diet drinks coming up. He walked away on the duckboards, wadding up his bar rag, tossing it into a sink. My face felt small and tight. My eardrums were ringing. Don't do that again, Cleet.
He's foisting drinks on people, I set him straight.
Did you hear me?
Climb down off it, Streak.
Off what?
You know what I'm talking about.
No, I don't, I said.
I gave up trying to pork everything in sight. Why? Because I'm old, and I make an idiot of myself. It's called recognizing your limitations.
See you later, I said.
Come back here.
But I kept walking, letting the noise in the dining room swallow up my conversation with Cleet and the temptations that were as abiding in me as sexual desire, and even worse, that had to do with guns and gambling and the rush of stepping through the dimension into a place I never wanted to go again. Levon and Rowena and Jimmy were sloshed and had stupid smiles on their faces when I got to the table. Sorry, something just came up, I said. You're leaving? Levon said. We'll do it another time, I said. Thanks for inviting me.
You got your nose bent out of shape, Rowena said. Just throw the food to the hogs.
Shakana Songut, I said. Then I walked out of the dining room and past the revelers at the bar, including Cleet, and out the door and into the night. The street was empty. The great looming structure called the Shadows, illuminated by floodlights in the yard. A tribute to all the suffering passed down to us by the antebellum era. What a joke, I thought. But my cynicism gave me no release from the fire and the insatiable need burning inside me. Chapter 5 Cleet called me at the office in the morning.
I'm sorry about last night, he said.
Forget it. I had my head on sideways, I said.
You didn't go home and get wasted, did you?
Worry about yourself, I said.
I'll see you for lunch.
I've got too much desk work.
I'll come by tonight. It's about that prick.
Which prick?
That prick Nightingale. Who else? I've got to pick up a bail skip in Jennings. I'll see you about 9.
At 5:15 p.m., I threw my tackle box and rod and reel into the back of my truck, hooked up my boat and trailer, and drove to the Henderson Levee outside Bro Bridge. Henderson Swamp is part of the vast network of bayous and bays and rivers that constitute the Atchafalaya Basin. The flooded woods are golden green at sunset, and so swollen with silence that you wonder if this piece of primordial creation was save by a divine hand to remind us of what the earth was like when our ancestors grew feet and crawled out of the sea. The cypress trees were in early leaf, as delicate as green lace, ruffling in the breeze, the water high and black and undisturbed, chained with lily pads, the bream and goggle-eye perch rolling under the pads like pillows of air floating to the surface. I cut my outboard and let my boat glide silently into a cove lit by a molten red sun, then flipped my plug in an arching loop just beyond a clutch of flooded willows. The western sky was streaked with clouds as pink as flamingo wings. In the distance, I heard the southern Pacific blowing down the line. But if I had come here for solace, my journey was in vain. The loss of my wife, my inability to accept the suddenness of the accident, the words of a paramedic telling me she was gone and they had done everything they could, his mouth moving like that of someone in a film with no soundtrack. I carried all these things wherever I went, my blood and mind fouled, the ground shifting, the realization at sunrise that her death was not a dream and that she was gone forever. Unfairly taken, her dignity and courage and spiritual resolve extinguished by a fool rounding a curve in a pickup truck the accelerator mashed to the floor. These thoughts robbed the light from my eyes. The bird song from the trees. And the sound of children playing in a park. Instead of the glory of the sunset, I saw beer cans and styrofoam cups undulating in the shallows. A rubber tire submerged among the willows. A blanket of debris caught in the cattails. As viscous as dried paint skimmed off the top of a paint bucket. I retrieved my lure and started the engine and drove back to the levee, the bow scraping on the concrete ramp like fingernails on a blackboard. I stopped into a bait shop and ate a sandwich on the gallery and watched the last of the sun slip beyond the trees. Several men were drinking beer at a spool table next to me. I believed I knew one of them, but I couldn't say for sure. They invited me to join them. I could not get my mind off Molly. Her warmth and steadfastness as a companion, her ability to deal with the sorrow and suffering of the world and not be undone by it. "Everything cool, buddy?" a man said. "Sure. I look like my gyroscope is busted," I replied. "Have a brew. I have to be on my way." "I should, too," he said. "My old lady is going to throw my supper in the backyard. Is yours like that?" The sun was only an ember when I drove down the levee. A few minutes later, I was on the two-lane highway outside Bro Bridge, the sky dark with rain clouds, when a pickup truck got on the back of my trailer and the driver clicked on his high beams, flooding the inside of my truck with light. I tried to see the driver's face in the rearview mirror, but his headlights were blinding. I touched my brake pedal to no avail. I had broken the clamp-on emergency flasher I'd carried in my truck only 2 days earlier. There were ditches on either side of the road and no shoulder where I could pull off. My eyes were watering from the glare in the mirror. Like anyone who has been harassed on the road by a tailgater, I felt my anger begin to rise, slowly at first, then build into an emotional straitjacket, and I began to have thoughts I did not associate with who I was. I pressed the brake again, this time hard, but he didn't back off. His headlights were so close they were beneath the level of my trailer. I accelerated. He dropped back a few feet in the mirror, and I saw a pipe bumper welded on the front of his vehicle. Then he came at me again. As I neared the convenience store at the intersection, he roared through the blinking red light and shot me the finger. The truck was pale blue, one side gnarled with dents, one taillight broken. I saw the driver for only seconds. His hair was black, his face unshaved. He looked like thousands of Cajun men. I drove home, my wrists throbbing. Cleet was sitting on the steps, tossing acorns at nothing, a fedora slanted on his brow. I pulled my trailer around his caddy and parked it on the grass. The leaves crackled under my feet as I crossed the yard. He sniffed. "You have a cold?" I asked.
"I smell beer."
I was sitting next to some guys at a bait shop. His eyes searched my face. I looked away down the street. The street lamps were on, rain dripping from the oaks. The sidewalk was arched in the places where the oak roots had broken through the concrete. The only sound was the whir of automobile tires on the street.
"I told Nightingale to stick his deal," Cleet said.
"You're not going to work it out with him?"
"You don't work out things with a guy like Nightingale. You park one in his ear."
"When did you get this bright idea?"
"Last night. I couldn't sleep. I felt dirty all over."
"What are you going to do, Cleet?"
"Nig and Wee Willie will front me $100,000.
"At what interest rate?"
"I didn't ask."
"How much do you owe?"
"Altogether, with loans all over the city and back interest and my maxed-out credit cards and the Vigorish and principal with the Shylocks, close to $250,000.
"How'd you do this, Cleet?"
"Why don't you try to make me feel bad?"
I sat down next to him. "I'll get a loan on the house."
"Not for me, you won't."
"I'll do it whether you like it or not." He shook his head, his hands between his knees.
"What can they do?"
"You know what they can do."
"I'll go out smoking."
"Why did you change your mind about Nightingale's offer?"
The skip I had to pick up in Jennings is a pimp and meth dealer. His name is Kevin Penny. Ever hear of him?
No.
This is the third time I've had to go after him. I almost capped him once. In custody. His little boy told the welfare worker what Penny did to him. I knew what he was going to do to his kid when he made the street.
He stopped and tapped his fist up and down on his thighs. What is it? I said.
I'm not being honest. Earlier, Penny told me about what a sleaze Nightingale was. You think Nightingale is a gentleman or something, but I know better. Nonetheless, I was going to take the deal with him. I didn't want to lose my place in the quarter. Whatever principles I have, I was willing to sell them out.
So what did this guy Penny tell you?
He delivered coke to Nightingale's house, and a girl or two.
Every one of these guys has a story like that. They've sold dope to George W. Bush or set up trysts for John Kennedy. Don't buy any of this crap, Cleet.
Penny says he's deposited money in a bank account of a company owned by Nightingale. He was even taught how to structure it, to make the deposits in amounts of less than $10,000 so the bank doesn't report it to the IRS.
I don't buy it.
Those eight women who were killed,
Cleet said,
they haunt me.
He wasn't alone. I'd worked with a task force on some of those homicides in Jeff Davis Parish. Eight young women, all of them poor, all of them involved with drugs and prostitution, were found with their throats cut or so badly decomposed in a swamp that the cause of death couldn't be determined. At the same time, there was a series of kidnappings and murders in East and West Baton Rouge parishes. Those victims were also dumped in wetlands areas. We thought we had the killers. In fact, Cleet and I helped take them off the board. We were wrong. The murders in Jeff Davis Parish came out of a culture that many Americans would not be able to understand. An aggregate of corrupt cops, ignorance, greed, misogyny, cruelty, sexual degradation, drug addiction, and ultimately, collective indifference toward the fate of people who have neither power nor voice. I'm talking about a new social class, one that is not racially defined. They come out of the womb addicted to crack and booze, have only a semblance of a family, drift from town to town selling themselves, or dealing dope, or stealing to buy it. The irony is they're not criminals, not in the traditional sense. They're pitiful. Sad and vulnerable, gathered up in bus stations like Grunion at high tide.
Have you eaten? I said.
My stomach's not right,
Cleet said.
Come inside.
Dave?
Yeah?
Are you back on the sauce?
I have some potato salad and cold chicken inside.
Damn it. Damn it. Damn it, he said.
I walked ahead of him into the kitchen and clicked on a light. I thought I saw a raccoon on the window ledge staring through the screen. When I looked outside, the yard was empty and windswept, tormented by shadows. Early the next morning, I got a call I didn't expect.
Is that you, Robichaud?
Who's calling? I said.
How many people got pustules in their throat and sound like a rusty sewer pipe?
Tony?
Tell the maid to give you a blowjob.
How did you get this number?
It cost me $1.95 on the internet. I think I got fucked. Speaking of which, you put a posthole digger up my ass.
In what way?
Jimmy Nightingale said he was going to get that Civil War sword appraised. Now he tells me he gave it to Levon Brissard. But he'll give me $10,000 reimbursement. I told him to change his $10,000 into nickels and shoved him up his nose. Why'd you do this to me?
Do what?
Introduce Nightingale to this raider.
What do you care? I said.
I'm on third base. I want to produce one of the guy's books. I'm talking about Cable. That's where they're making real art, not this computerized stuff.
I couldn't believe I was having a conversation about art with a man who had chopped up an enemy, freeze-dried the parts, and hung them from a wood-bladed ceiling fan in a family grocery on magazine. I don't know anything about that, Tony. I went to dinner with Jimmy and the Broussards. I also left the dinner.
I treated you decent. You stabbed me in the back.
Fire your psychiatrist. He's not helping you.
I should have known better,
he said. About what?
You're a juicer. The kind that don't ever get cured. You got no honor.
I'm going to hang up now. Don't call here again.
Like I want to,
he replied. I walked to work. It had rained during the night, and the sky had cleared, and the sun had come up bright and hot, and the lawns of the antebellum and Victorian homes along East Main were sprinkled with the pink and red petals of the azalea bushes that bloomed all over Louisiana in the early spring. I passed the grotto and the statue of Jesus's mother next to the library, and walked down the long oak-shaded drive to the huge brick building on the bayou where I made my livelihood. I poured a cup of coffee and went to Helen Swallow's office. The door was open. I tapped on the jamb just the same. "What's shaking, Buona?" she said from behind her desk. "Can I close the door?" She nodded, her face somber, as it always was in enclosed or personal situations. I pulled up a chair. She waited for me to speak. "Did you ever hear anything about Jimmy Nightingale having ties to dope or prostitution? Around Jeff Davis Parish in particular?" "No. In fact, that sounds ridiculous. I feel the same way. Where'd you hear this?" "Cleet got it from a pimp named Kevin Penny."
"Great source."
"That's what I said."
"Then why are you asking me?"
"It bothered me. I just introduced Jimmy to Levon Broussard and his wife." She picked up her ballpoint and flipped it into the air and let it bounce on her ink blotter.
"Why do you get mixed up with these people, Dave?"
"What kind of question is that?"
"I'll answer it for you. Both you and Cleet hate the rich, but pretend you don't."
"Next time I try to come in your office, don't let me in."
"Okay, maybe that's unfair. But maybe your deeper motivation is even worse."
I got up to go.
"You want to believe people are better than they are," she said.
"Send me a bill for that, will you?"
"Buona, go now. Buona, also shut mouth."
Nobody put the slide or the glide on Helen Swallow. I'd like to be humble and say Helen read both Cleet and me correctly. To a degree, I guess she did, but there was a larger issue at work. You cannot watch the exhumation of a murdered woman from a bog and ever be quite the same. The degradation by the elements of an unpreserved human body is not a kind one. The earth, the primeval soup, if you will, is tenacious. It clings to the skin, peels it from the arms and face, the hair from the scalp. The eyes remain sunken, sometimes looking at you oddly, like chipped marbles pushed into dough by an insensitive thumb. The 8 women who were killed had no advocate. The cops assigned to the case early on were pitiful, if not complicit. Any cop who is honest will tell you there are police officers in our midst who never should have been given power over others. Misogamy is a big part of their makeup. Sexual perversity as well. I've known both male and female vice cops who have the psychological makeup of degenerates and closet sadists. I've also known gun bulls who would have had no problem working in Dachau. That we protect them is beyond my comprehension. The hundreds of cops and firemen who went into the towers on 9/11 knew they probably would not come out. What are the limits of human courage? The cops and firemen who walked into stairwells that were not stairwells, but chimneys filled with flame and smoke, proved that the human spirit is unconquerable, and it is these men and women who define what is best in us. The 8 women who were murdered and dumped like bags of trash in a swamp probably never would find justice. The thought that Jimmy Nightingale was involved in the subculture responsible for their deaths gave me no rest. Plus, I had introduced him in good faith to Levon and Rowena Broussard. I called him at his home. The same curt secretary answered. "This is Detective Robichaud," I said. "Is Mr. Nightingale there?"
"No, he isn't."
"Can you tell me where he is?"
"No."
"Excuse me?"
"He's flying right now."
"Flying where?"
"I wouldn't know. He's flying his plane. Can I assist you with something?"
"I wanted to ask him about charm schools. Do you have contact with any?"
"I'll certainly pass on the information."
"I didn't get your name."
Emmeline Nightingale. I'm his cousin. It's nice to meet you, if only over the phone. Thank you. Goodbye.
Franklin was a short drive down the bayou. I checked out a cruiser, turned on the flasher, and headed down Old Spanish Trail into the past, into the fury and mire of bloodline complexities our ancestors tried to wall up with brick and plaster and mortar, hoping the earth would subsume and cover forever the sins they could not. Jimmy's father had been known as a hunter of big game in Africa, an archaeologist and mining engineer, a linguist and a world-traveling swordsman who may have been killed by a British parliamentarian he cuckolded. The mother came from the north and was disdainful and private and, in all probability, very unhappy and consequently very angry. She broke her neck in a steeplechase when Jimmy was 15. I followed Jimmy's driveway through a tunnel of oaks and parked in front of the columned porch on the house. I stepped out on the gravel and looked at the enormity of the house, the immaculate creamy quality of the paint, the wraparound second-story veranda that Southern Belles had probably stood on in their finery and watched the boys in tattered butternut march down a long, dusty road to defeat and privation or a Yankee prison. I heard the sound of a single-engine plane that had started to sputter as though out of gas. The plane, one with pontoons, was a dull red and drifted like a leaf out of a deep blue cloudless sky. It touched down on the bayou's surface at the same moment the propeller locked in a stationary position. Jimmy opened the cabin door and threw a small anchor attached to a rope over his dock, pulled the rope until it snugged tight, then brought the plane hand over hand into the shallows. He stepped up onto the dock as though alighting from a pleasure boat. I walked down the slope, the wind cool, wimpling the water. His egg-shaped face was ruddy, his eyes bright, every hair on his head perfectly in place. "Has a crime wave hit Franklin?" he said. "You tell me." "Why'd you leave my table at Clementine's?" "I didn't like the way things were going." "You mean Rowena's wandering eye?" "You said it, I didn't." "She's a young woman. What's the harm?" "Her husband might have an opinion."
"Dave, you're a Puritan, and you know it. Come inside."
"Do you know a lowlife by the name of Kevin Penny?"
"A lowlife? Let me see."
"Nope.
Who is he?"
"A pimp and a meth dealer. He says he's delivered dope and women to your house."
"Grand. Anything else?"
"He says he makes deposits in a bank account used by your company. He operates around the Jennings area."
"Let's go inside. I have some aspirin in the kitchen. How about a cold washcloth on the forehead?"
"None of this is true." He walked ahead of me, looking over his shoulder.
"It's good I like you."
"I don't think you get it, Jimmy. This isn't a courtesy call."
"No, it isn't. It's a visitation by a lunatic."
I caught up with him and slipped my hand under his arm. I turned him around. He seemed surprised. "Lose the attitude, Jimmy," I said. He looked down at my hand.
"All right, I will. My attitude is one of kindness to you. I respect your service to the country and your service to the community. You've been through perfect misery in the last 2 years. That isn't lost on me or others. Learn who your bloody friends are, Dave."
"Been hanging with the Aussies?"
"That's a cheap shot.
Tony Nemo says you shafted him.
And Tony has a fried egg for a brain."
"I think Levon Broussard is a decent and honorable man," I said. "I also think he's naive. Nobody's going to use me to hurt him."
Jimmy put his hands on his hips and looked at the bayou, his face cool and handsome and at peace. "I don't know what to say. Come have a cold drink with me, please."
"This guy Penny is lying?"
"Regarding me, he is. I never heard of the guy."
I looked him in the face.
"As God is my witness," he added.
"Okay?"
"Okay what?"
"I accept your word."
"There you go," he said, and hit me on the back.
We walked up the slope into his backyard, past a gazebo and camellia bushes in full bloom, and trellises dripping with roses and wisteria, the St. Augustine grass so thick and dark green and cold and stiff in the shade that it looked and felt like artificial turf. A woman opened the back door. She wore a black suit and hose. Her hair was black, too, pulled straight back, her skin the color of paste, her eyes dark and luminous as though she had a fever. "I'm Emmeline."
"How do you do, Miss Emmeline? I'm Dave Robichaux."
"Did you have engine trouble again?" she said to Jimmy.
"Wasn't watching the fuel gauge, I'm afraid. Nothing to be worried about. With pontoons, you can land almost anywhere in Louisiana. What did our local congressman say? Half the state is underwater, the other half under indictment."
"Would you like a highball or a glass of wine, Detective Robichaux?"
"No, thank you."
"On the clock, are you?"
"Yes. I must be going. It's nice meeting you in person."
She didn't reply, as though I hadn't spoken. The wind picked up, sprinkling leaves that were as hard as the shells of crustaceans on the grass. It was cold in the shade, the light on the 4 o'clocks and caladiums harsh and brittle. We were in the midst of spring, yet I felt a sense of mortality I couldn't explain. Her face was impossible to read. She was one of those women who seemed to choose solitude and plainness over beauty and anger over happiness. "You ever meet a guy named Kevin Penny?" I said.
"Our convict gardener," she replied. "I fired him."
I looked at Jimmy. He shrugged and turned up his palms.
"I don't know the name of every guy who cuts the grass, Dave."
"What is this about?" Emmeline said.
"Veracity," I said.
"I don't care for your tone," she said.
"I don't blame you. It bothers me, too." I pointed my finger at Jimmy Nightingale.
"I think you're slick."
"I'm dishonest?" "Take it any way you want."
"You've got some damn nerve," he said. "Tell it to the 8 murdered women in Jeff Davis Parish," I replied.
"What do they have to do with me?"
"I heard you hung around Bobby Earle because you wanted his mailing list." "I never believed that," I said.
"It's politics. This is Louisiana."
I remember many situations when I said it was just Vietnam.
Jimmy pulled the cork from a green half-empty bottle of wine. "Here's to neo-colonialism everywhere."
I wasn't up to his cynicism. I looked at the oaks, the moss lifting in the wind, purple dust rising from a cane field, Bayou Teche glinting in the sun like a Byzantine shield. La Louisiane. The love of my life, the home of Joly Blanc and Evangeline and the great whore of Babylon, the place for which I would die, the place for which there was no answer or cure. I said nothing more and walked to my vehicle, rude or not.
Chapter 6. Recovering alcoholics have ways of setting themselves up. Some get the toxins out of their system and stop attending meetings. Maybe they hang with the old crowd. They drop by a saloon to watch a football game on a Saturday afternoon. They convince themselves their problems had to do with excess rather than compulsion and metabolic addiction and deep-seated neuroses, armor-plated in the unconscious. Or they nurse resentment and fuel their anger on a daily basis like a primitive, fur-clad creature methodically dropping sticks into a fire. Or maybe they want to cancel their whole ticket, but are afraid to lose their soul. If they're in this category, they'll commit suicide in an incremental fashion, one glass or bottle at a time. And if the process isn't fast enough, they will put themselves in dangerous situations involving guns and knives and people who belong in steel cages. I went to a meeting at the Episcopalian cottage on Center Street, across from Old New Iberia High. When the moderator asked if anyone was attending AA for the first time, or if anyone was returning from a slip and wanted a 24-hour sobriety chip, I let my face go empty and stared at the floor in the semi-darkness. At the end of the meeting, I said little or nothing to friends with whom I had been in the program for years, and drove to my house in a heavy white fog that had moved in from the Gulf and parked my truck in the porte-cochere and went inside and sat in the living room in the dark, the television off, the silence as loud as a scream. The operative acronym for every AA member is HALT, which means don't get hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. I was all of those. I called Cleet's cell phone, which went immediately to voicemail. I didn't want the food in my icebox. I woke, lifeless and exhausted, with every sunrise. My hands opened and closed at my sides for no reason. I deliberately revisited memories of a human face dissolving in a bloody mist when I squeezed off round after round from my Army issue 1911 Model 45. I'm not proud of any of these things. I hated them then. I hate them now. But they live in me like a snake that slowly swallows its prey, compressing it into a canister of despair and pain. I went into the kitchen and filled a large glass with tap water and drank it to the bottom. In the darkness, I heard the claws of an animal scratching at the screen. I set the glass quietly in the sink and went through the mud room and opened the screen door. A raccoon that must have weighed 25 pounds jumped from the windowsill and thumped on the ground, then scampered through the leaves past Tripod's old hutch and disappeared inside the fog. I walked down the slope looking for him. The air was cold, the fog hanging in huge clouds on the bayou and in the trees. I heard a splash like a gator slapping its tail. I took a penlight from my pocket and shone it on the ground. The tracks of a raccoon and probably a possum or an armadillo were stenciled along the mud flat. The tracks disappeared into the cattails. Farther down, inside clouds of fog that rose 4 feet above the water, I heard a soft knocking sound, like a friend at the door in the early hours. I shined the light ahead of me. The tide was coming in. And an unmoored pirogue had floated up the bayou and lodged against a decayed and collapsed dock at the foot of my property. I picked up a fallen tree branch and hooked it on the pirogue's bow and scraped it onto the bank. There was a paddle inside, an empty rucksack, a minnow bucket, a newspaper that was 2 weeks old, and a fish stringer. My earliest memories of my father were fishing with him in a pirogue. There is no more emblematic symbol of life on Bayou Teche than the humble pirogue. I stepped into the pirogue and steadied my weight, then eased down on the wood seat. The fog was so thick that the lights in the houses along the bayou, even the flood lamps in the backyard of the shadows, and the warning lights on the drawbridge at Burke Street were hardly more than smudges. I shone the penlight on the rucksack again. A pint bottle of brandy lay in a half inch of rainwater. I touched it with the penlight beam and watched its color flare on my hand and wrist. I pushed with the paddle until the pirogue swung into the current and began to drift toward the bridge and one of the places that had been waiting for me since I was a child, when, in my innocence, I believed the paradisiacal world into which I had been born would always be there for me. This particular bar and grill was located on the water, but because of the fog and the intermittent rain, the chairs and tables on the deck had been stacked and all the patrons had gone inside and crowded into the bar. The windows were lighted, the glass beaded, the patrons happy and warm, safe from the elements. The only problem I had with this place upstream from the drawbridge was that almost everyone there knew me and my history. When I opened the door, the bartender looked at me without speaking. I pointed at the men's room. He smiled. "Yeah, go ahead, Dave," he said. I went into the cubicle inside the restroom and shut the door. I waited until I was sure the room was empty, then exited the cubicle and clicked off the light to lessen my visibility, and opened the restroom door and went to the end of the bar in the shadows. A young barmaid I didn't recognize was filling the beer box. One of those and two shots of Jack on shaved ice, I said. In fact, make that two doubles. I got a friend coming. She was pretty and young, and had a small red mouth and the amber-colored hair characteristic of many Cajun women.
Aren't you?
Aren't I who?
You know, a policeman. You work in the big building on the bayou. I seen you when I paid a traffic ticket there.
Yeah, that was probably me. I'm kind of in a hurry.
Don't set your pants on fire, no.
I stood by the stool. I looked at my hands. I looked down at the bar rail. I could feel 100 eyes burning into my back or the side of my face. When I looked up, no one was paying me any attention. Miss, I'd really appreciate it if you'd hurry.
Yes, sir, coming up, she said.
After I finished both glasses of whiskey, chasing each with Heineken, I thought my knees would fold.
You're going to be all right,
the barmaid said. As right as rain.
You don't look it, no.
You're an honest lady.
No, I ain't. I just don't want to have to clean up the flow.
See, that's honesty.
She leaned in. You ain't driving, you.
What's your name?
Babette Lacholet.
I wish there were a million like you, Miss Babette. Give me a Heineken for the road. I pushed a 22 her with the heel of my hand and left the change on the bar, then went outside into the fog and rain and started walking home. The drawbridge at Burke Street was in the air, a tugboat working its way up the bayou, its running lights on. I waved at the man in the pilot house. I saw him draw in on his pipe and wave back. I wanted to have a drink with him. I wanted to be on his boat and sail back into time. Find a place where there were no clocks or calendars. I wanted to find the vortex that some say is the birth canal and others say is the conduit to eternity. I wanted to find the cowled figure that awaits us all and wrap myself in his cloak. I remember reaching my front yard and starting my truck with the intention of driving to St. Martinville, the village where the ghost of Evangeline supposedly waited for her lover, Gabriel, under a spreading oak on the banks of Bayou Teche. My next memory is of headlights in my mirror and the grinding sounds of a vehicle on my bumper. I woke in my skivvies, on top of the sheets, the sun in my eyes. When I sat up, a wave of nausea drained through my body. My elbows hurt, and my knuckles were scraped, and one fingernail was broken all the way to the cuticle. My clothes were on the floor. The sleeves of my windbreaker looked like they had been raked by barbed wire. I threw up in the bathroom, the backs of my legs shaking. I got into the shower and turned on the water as hot as I could stand it, filling the room with steam, boiling the grease out of my pores as though trying to scour an obscene presence from my skin. I touched a painful bump under the white patch in my hair and another bump on the back of my head. I shaved and brushed my teeth and gargled with antiseptic and tried to remember where I had gone and what I had done the previous night. My memory would go no deeper than the blinding glare in the rearview mirror, the smash of a bumper against the rear of my truck, and my head snapping back. No, I remembered something else. A man's face. His teeth were wide set, his throat and cheeks patinaed with whiskers that were as stiff as emery wheel filings. I looked into the bathroom mirror. My face was bloodless and gaunt and dissolute, my eyes swollen, my hair a tangle of snakes. I scrubbed my face with cold water and looked again and saw an image that could be compared only with the severed head of a Mongol warrior. I dressed in a long-sleeved red silk shirt and gray tie and gray slacks and oxblood loafers and got to the department at 5 to 8. I had never felt so sick. I filled a styrofoam cup with coffee and burned my mouth on the first sip. Helen stopped me in the hallway before I could make it to my office, where I hope to recover in solitude from my hangover.
Drink up, Pops. We've got a homicide.
Where?
I said. Just this side of St. Martin Line.
No shooting?
Mixed reports. The coroner's on his way. Dump the coffee. I've got to use the men's room. You don't have one at home?
I got a bug.
Her eyes wandered over my face. I'll bring a cruiser around. Get your shit together.
Pardon?
You haven't been fooling anyone.
She walked away, her back stiff with anger.
Helen drove up the two-lane toward St. Martinville without speaking, the flasher rippling. I looked out the window at the cane fields flying by, the sun spangling through the canopy of oaks that arched over the highway.
Who's at the scene? I asked.
Spade LaBiche.
What's he doing out here?
He was investigating a domestic battery charge. He got patched in.
She waited for me to reply.
What?
Nothing.
You don't like him?
I don't have an opinion.
Dave, what is wrong with you? Why not put one in your mouth and be done with it?
I'm going to hit a noon meeting.
What you're going to do is your goddamn job.
Whatever you say.
I'll stop the cruiser and stomp the shit out of you.
I believe you. I'm sorry.
I don't have words for how I feel. You break my heart.
I knew I would hear that last one in my sleep. We turned onto a road that made a wide bend through sugarcane fields and cattle pasture and past clumps of pecan and oak trees and box-like farmhouses and trailers and a convenience store that sold live bait. Just past the convenience store, a pale blue pickup truck was parked in knee-high weeds 30 feet beyond a broken wire fence. Both doors were shut.
Crime scene tape had been strung from the fence post to a solitary oak beyond the truck. The tape was bouncing in the wind.
Spade LaBiche came from a big family in New Orleans that made a living out of law enforcement and jails. They were either cops, chasers in the Marine Corps, hacks in Angola, or Huntsville, or parchment, or bail bondsmen. Without criminals, they would not have had a livelihood. Spade LaBiche had worked vice at Miami-Dade and claimed he had resigned because he was homesick for Louisiana. He had started off in uniform with our department and only recently made plain clothes. Twice women of color had filed sexual complaints against him, but the complaints were dropped without explanation. LaBiche was standing just outside the tape, wearing an ink-blue tie sprayed with tiny white stars and a suit that was as bright as tin. A pair of latex gloves hung out of his side pocket. He lit a cigarette with a match, cupping the flame in the wind. Normally he carried a gold lighter because there was little he did that wasn't ostentatious. He was blonde and trim and worked out every night at Barron's Health Club. His eyes were almost colorless, like glass with a tinge of blue.
"The body's on the other side," he said. "You might check the window on the driver's side first."
"Where's the coroner?" Helen said.
"Taking a whiz in a convenience store," he said.
"Did he examine the body?"
"Yeah,"
LaBiche said. "What did he say?" Helen asked.
"Nothing. He went blank on me, the way guys like that do."
"Which kind of guys?" I asked. He fixed his gaze on my face, a curl at the edge of his mouth.
"Unusual ones?"
Helen and I put on latex gloves. I kept my hands down, out of sight, and tried not to flinch when I pulled the latex over my knuckles. The glass had been knocked out of the window. There was a ragged line of shards sticking out of the jamb like shark's teeth.
"There's glass all over the dashboard and the seat and on the weeds," LaBiche said. "There's some pieces in the Vic's hair, too."
"Did you run the tag?" Helen said.
"The truck is registered to T.J. D'Artez," he said.
I kept my face empty, my arms folded on my chest. The front bumper was made from welded pipes. One taillight was broken. "Where are the paramedics?" I said.
"Fuck if I know."
"How about it on the language?" I said. I squatted down by the body. D'Artez lay on his back, his shirt front cut and bloodied perpendicularly.
His teeth were knocked out. One eye had eight-balled. My head was spinning as though I were in free fall. LaBiche had thrown his cigarette.